We're starting another year, as we always do this time of year. We are going to see if we can finish the book of Numbers today. I know I've said grand things like that before and never delivered, but we'll see how things go. We are in chapter 27 of the book of Numbers. We affectionately call the wilderness book, as is used by the Jewish name for this book. Chapter 26, we had another census. If you remember, what the book began with, a census, and then we have another census taken in chapter 26. Do you remember what the difference was between the why we're doing it again? Why are we doing another census in chapter 26? We just did it 15 chapters ago. Why are we doing it again? Do you remember? This is the next generation. Yes, Captain Picard. So we are in the next generation of things. And so here we are in a situation where those that did not choose to go into the land the first time, they're all dead. They're all dead. And so now we are the next generation. And as I mentioned before, the wilderness period, a lot of what we're doing in the wilderness is getting Egypt out of the Israelites. We're getting all their practice, what they knew before. And they kept talking about, well, we want to go back and enjoy the leeks and the whatever, and the plant, whatever, all the list of things they wanted to go back into Egypt. And now we have a generation that says, what's Egypt? We have a new generation that knows not Egypt and has completely been raised in the desert by and large. And so now we are in this second phase. In chapter 27, we have an interesting case. A case of an inheritance for when there are no males, and we're going to get into more law and that kind of thing at the end of the chapter, at the end of the book here. So there are some daughters of Zelophehad, the son of Hepher, the son of Gilead, and the son of Machir, the son of Manasseh, of the families of Manasseh, and so they come and they say, "There's no male to inherit land. What can we do?" And so they are told in this chapter that they would be able to inherit the land. In verse 6 through 11, we're given the law that they would be able to inherit the land, and that as long as they married in the family of Manasseh, so that no land would travel or go to another tribe. In verse 12, God shows Moses the land. Beginning of verse 12, the Lord said to Moses, "Go up to this mountain of Abiram and see the land which I have given to the sons of Israel. When you have seen it, you too will be gathered to your people, as Aaron your brother was. For in the wilderness of Sin, during the strife of the congregation, you rebelled against my command to treat me as holy before their eyes at the water. These are the waters of Meribah, of Kadesh, in the wilderness of Sin." And we remember that took place in Numbers chapter 12. What was he supposed to do? Do you remember? He's supposed to speak to the rock. And he decided to do what? To strike it. He hit it. We don't know where I'm supposed to be hitting things. And he also said that he and Aaron were the ones that were doing this. And so what God said here is, "You didn't treat me as holy. You treated me as some common thing and did not regard me as holy." Hebrews chapter 4, verse 1 talks about those in that time who came short of the promise because they were not obedient. And Moses was one of those who came short of the promise. He was able to see it from afar, but never got to enter into the promised land. And so the warning that we're given in Hebrews is the same kind of warning that they were given. Don't Be obedient so you don't come short of the promises. And we need to do the same thing. Make sure that we're obedient to what God has given us so that we don't come short, as is mentioned in Hebrews chapter 4, verse 1. And so here we are entering into... Now Moses begins in verse 15. "Then Moses spoke to the Lord, saying, 'May the Lord God of the spirits of all flesh appoint a man over the congregation who will go out and come in before them and who will lead them out and bring them in, so the congregation of the Lord will not be like our sheep having no shepherd.'" And so Moses, when he hears, that he will not go in, his concern is for the leadership, which we would expect from a leader. His concern is for the leadership of the people. They need somebody to lead them, or they will be like what? Like sheep which have no shepherd. Have you heard that before? Jesus said that in Matthew 9:36, Mark 6:34. When he behold the people, he had compassion upon them, for they were like sheep without a shepherd. Have you seen sheep without a shepherd before? How many of you have like seen like actual sheep? There's a few of us. In Idaho, there are a lot of Basque peoples, and they are famous for raising sheep. And we were up in the hills one day, up at church camp. Camp Ivydale is what we called it. We didn't call it Central Florida Bible Camp. It was Camp Ivydale. And there was a well that had just a covering over it, and two sheep who were just wandering around fell into that well. And they were just trying to stay afloat. And if sheep are wandering around without any shepherd, they're going to get into trouble, like these two sheep did. And so in this case, Christ had compassion on them because they were just wandering around. They had no direction, nobody to lead them. And that's exactly what Moses was concerned for. So again, over and over again, we see this type and anti-type with Moses and Christ, concerned for how the people are going to be. And that is in Matthew 9:36 and Mark 6:34. And so he begins to name Joshua as the next successor. He says, take Joshua, the son of Nun, a man in whom is a spirit, and lay your hand on him, and have him stand before Eleazar the priest and before the congregation, and commission him in their sight. And so we are given this sort of passing of the mantle, so to speak, of what is supposed to happen whenever that time comes. And we read here that Moses, in verse 22, did just as the Lord commanded. And so the people know that Joshua is going to be the next guy. Moses isn't dead yet. That doesn't happen until, we don't see that until Deuteronomy, but or at the end of Deuteronomy. So here we're given this information. But we have an interesting thing here. Moreover, he shall stand before Eleazar, in verse 21, the priest, who shall inquire for him by the judgment of the Urim before the Lord. And his command, they shall go out at his command, and they shall come in. The judgment of the Urim, what is that? What is this Urim that you speak of? Yes, it is how. Yes, the Urim and the Thummim was what was used to sort of a DVNR. I forgot the how to decision making. Yes, I could not a DVNR. You wouldn't know that in Spanish, but that's what was stuck in my head. How they would discern what God would want them to do. We really don't even know what they are exactly. If you Google these things, you see a lot of black and white stones with some writing on them. We really don't know what they are. We see them first mentioned in Exodus 28:30, and they are to be kept with the high priest in that breastplate, or as though there were a pocket behind it or a pocket there with that breastplate. And we see them used extensively in 1 Samuel 14:41, and then again in 28:6, 1 Samuel 14:41. And then in 1 Samuel 28:6, where at one point they're saying, we're not even getting any answer from God, not even from the Urim and the Thummim. We're not even getting any answer from God. And so this was a way of discerning what the will of God was by casting of lots. And we see this happen in the New Testament. We see this happen in the New Testament. When a new apostle is appointed, they cast lots. And that's where they get this concept from. It wasn't like they were rolling dice to see who the new apostles were going to be. They were doing this concept of the Urim and the Thummim for God to decide what was going to be the next, or who's going to be the next apostle. And so this is an interesting concept. You'll see it kind of pop up in the history of the Old Testament, and this is what this is. And so Joshua was to use this in his discerning what the will of the Lord was. And it's interesting, it's a step down from the relationship that Moses had with God. Moses was able to talk with God. And so this was going to be a step down. Not that God would never talk with Joshua at any time, but in general, they would use this process. And then in chapter 28, we have some offerings that are given. We have verses 3 through 8, we have the daily offering. And verse 2 is rather interesting. Command the sons, God talking to Moses, command the sons of Israel and say to them, you shall be careful to present my offering, my food, for my offerings by the fire, a soothing aroma to me. So here's God talking about the offerings. You need to be careful to do them correctly. And what does he say about these offerings? Are they just offerings to any old person? How many times does he use this personal pronoun here? My, and me. These are for God. These offerings are for God. They're not for us. You know, if they wanted to offer something, they might have tried to offer something else that was a little less bloody, you know, or something other than sheep, for example. But God said, these, you be careful to do it the way I said to do it, and these are mine. And again, it goes into this concept of when we worship, the offering is for God. Our offering, when we come together to offer praise to God, it is for God. Now, there is mutual edification that takes place, and there are songs that we sing that are for each other. Why Not Tonight is not for God, okay? And so that's a song that we sing to encourage one another, but we are offering our offerings to God. So we need to make sure that in our worship we are keeping proper focus, and that's what he's saying here also, that these are mine. And so he goes through a list here, and we won't take time to go through all of these and read the details of every one of them, but I'll give you the breakdown here. The daily offering is mentioned in verses 3 through 8. The Sabbath offering is verses 9 and 10. There, in verses 11 through 15, they are to give an offering at the beginning of each month. 11 through 15. 16 through 25, we have the Passover offering. The Passover is mentioned again. And 26 through 31, we have the Day of First Fruits, or the Feast of Weeks. I don't know if you have there mentioned, it mentioned several times, Holy Convocation. You shall do no laborious work. And so it is a time, much like the Sabbath, in that you don't work on those specific days. The very last phrase I have in my version says that they shall be without defect in reference to the offerings. And I put out there beside in my notes, sin is expensive. Sin is expensive. We're going to look at some other offerings here, and then we'll look at some totals of the year. How many animals in these specific sacrifices are we talking about each year? In chapter 29, we begin to look at some offerings for the seventh month. This is also mentioned in Leviticus chapter 23, if you want to put that out in your notes. We have the Feast of Trumpets, verses 1 through 6, and it's a time for blowing trumpets. What trumpets are they blowing? Do you remember? We talked about trumpets earlier in this book. Are they blowing the bugle? Sounding reveille, they're blowing the silver trumpets. Remember that they used the trumpets when they were coming in and out, and they used the silver trumpets to organize their comings and goings as a camp. And there's a time when they would blow those trumpets. So I don't know. Hopefully they sounded good. Hopefully it wasn't like they're blowing the trumpets again. I could see how that might be, but it's a time for blowing trumpets is what we're saying. What it says here. And so verses 1 through 6, Leviticus 23, chapter 23, 24 and 25 mention this. And this is the first day of the seventh month, which is about mid-September when this took place. Then we have the Day of Atonement, verses 7 through 11. That is mentioned in Leviticus 16, 29 through 34. Leviticus 16, 29 through 34, and chapter 23, 26 through 32. And it says several times, and here, humble yourselves, or humble your soul during this time, Day of Atonement. And that is used in reference to fasting. So this time of the Day of Atonement, when you were to humble your soul before God, was a time in reference to fasting during the Day of Atonement. Verses 12 through 40, we have the Feast of Tabernacles. And we have different, because this lasts several days, mentions 8 days here. It's broken up into what they do each day. So Feast of Tabernacles 12 through 40. Again, this is mentioned in Leviticus 23, 33, and 35. And Deuteronomy 16, 13 through 15. And so you'll see as you go through that section, you can just kind of highlight day one, day two, what they did on the third day, and it breaks up each day. So a total for the year for these communal offerings, these are communal offerings. These are not the individual offerings. These are offerings they did as a community. We have 97 bulls, 29 rams, 1,035 lambs, and a sin offering is done 22 times. And so those are just the communal, based on the Hebrew calendar. Those are the things that that's about how many they did each year as far as killing of animals. And it was quite an extensive process. And again, remember that these, when we think of sacrificing animals, we think, well, you kill them and you throw them up on the big brazen altar and you let them burn. But what we've learned is that a portion of that animal would be burned and the meat would be given to the Israelites. It was for the Israelites, or for the Levites, the priests. And so those are as a way of that family, that group being taken care of. And we're actually going to see some of that later on if we get to the end of the book today. All right, we're going to talk in chapter 30 about vows. And there's 3 important rules about vows. How many of you have taken vows before? Anybody? If you're wearing a ring, you might have done that. But there's 3 important things about vows. According to verse 2 of chapter 30, vows are binding. The vows are binding. Imagine that, a vow being binding. And second thing, vows must be reported to one's immediate superior in verses 3 and 4. According to the Jewish customs, or what was written here as God's commanded, if you take a vow, let's say my son takes a vow and he's still in my household, I'm supposed to know about that vow. Because the next law is that the immediate superior may annul the rash vow. So let's say, you know, Josiah makes a vow. I will never eat frosted mini wheats ever again. And I'm like, well, that's a pretty rash vow. I'm just going to say no on that one. And so I'm able to annul the rash vow. And the same thing for any immediate superior. So fathers, husbands, that kind of thing. Now, if a girl makes a vow and it's a vow that her father allowed her to do, but she goes to get married, and her husband hears about the vow, the moment he hears about it, he can annul that vow. Say, no, we're not going to do that in our family. Let's just say no to that vow, and we'll start over. You know, so when they first hear about it, they're able to do it. But if they don't do anything, the moment they hear about it, then it's considered into full effect, and they're not allowed to change it after the fact. And so those are some things about vows as God is prescribing vows here in chapter 30. Any questions up to here? Yes.
Who was the one that stepped over the threshold?
Oh, yes. Coming back from war, he had made the first thing that stepped out of his house, he would offer to God. Jephthah was the guy. Yes, he could. He was the head of household. He could not have. That's why it was important. And there was no immediate superior to him. He could not have withdrawn that vow. And so what is assumed happened is that she was sort of, you know, dedicated to temple service, offered to God in that way, dedicated to temple service. Not that she was sacrificed in that way. So, very good question. All right, we're entering in the final section of Numbers with chapter 31. Chapter 31 through the end of Numbers, we have things that are concerning conquest. What are you going to do when you go into this new land? Here's some things you need to consider, and God gives them some instruction. But first, before we do that, we're going to smoke check some people in chapter 31. Remember the Midianites and the Moabites and how they were sneaky, and they sent their pretty girls over to Israel, because Balaam with the Moabites, they couldn't curse them. Remember, they couldn't curse them. It just wasn't working out for them. God wouldn't let it happen. And so they kind of snuck in some devious people over there and led them away to worship Baal. And 24,000 people died. And so that was in chapter 25. And so God, after all that happened, in chapter 25, verses 16 and 8 through 18, God says, you need to kill these people. You need to get rid of them. They have been deceitful with you. They have harmed you. They've been hostile towards you, is the word he uses. You need to be hostile back and get rid of them. And so chapter 31, God, they make preparations to do that. And Phinehas leads the charge. Phinehas was the man with the spear. Remember what happened with Phinehas? So they're mourning in chapter 25, those that had died, the 23,000 that had died immediately. And while they're mourning, this other guy brings another one of the girls into camp. And is walking through camp like, hey guys, I'll be out in a little bit. And goes into his tent with this girl. And Phinehas sees it, and he just grabs a spear. I mean, I don't think that Phinehas is just standing around with a spear. Probably not, you know. That's not something a priest would be standing around with. And so I imagine he was walking towards that tent, just grabbed a spear out of one of the guard's hands, went into the tent, and shish kebabbed him to the ground. And so you can imagine what they were doing if they were both shish kebabbed to the ground together. The Bible says they were pierced through their bellies and pinned to the ground. So we kind of get an idea of what they were doing. And God said he stayed the vengeance. He stopped what was going to happen. And so he leads the charge against the Midianites in chapter 31. And so we were given, they go into about 12,000 men go. They get 1,000 men from each tribe, 1,000 fighting men from each tribe. They go in and they go to war. And verse 7, so they made war against Midian, just as the Lord had commanded Moses, and they killed every male. They killed the kings of Midian, along with the rest of their slain, Evi, and Rechem, and Zur, and Hur, and Reba, and the five kings of Midian. They also killed Balaam, the son of Beor, with a sword. What's Balaam still doing here? Balaam wasn't even from around there. He was from up in the Euphrates area. He was still there. He should have gone home. He should have gone home. But they killed him also because of his deceitfulness. Because he was the one that gave them the information that, hey, you might want to try this, because what I'm doing is not working. So Balaam sold out, and he got killed because of it. And we are given some after-the-story information here. The sons of Israel captured the women of Midian and their little ones and all the cattle and all the flocks and all their goods, and then plundered. And they burned all the cities which they lived in, and their camps and fire, and they took the spoil and all the prey, both of man and beast, and they brought captives prey. And verse 13, Moses and Eleazar the priests and all the leaders of the congregation went out to meet them outside the camp. Because remember, Levitically, they were not allowed. They just killed people. And they're not allowed to come into the camp. And so they're outside the camp. They've come back. Moses and Eleazar go out to meet them. And Moses says, have you spared all the women? Behold, these caused the sons of Israel through the counsel of Balaam to trespass against the Lord in the matter of Peor. So the plague was among the congregation of the Lord. Now therefore kill every male among the little ones and every woman who has known man intimately. And so they were to purge all that. And so only those females that had not known man were able to stay, and they were used as slaves. At the end of this chapter, 25 through 54, talks about how they divided up the plunder and gives into an account of everything that was taken into account. Right out there beside your in your passage, if you have room, Ezekiel 33:11. Ezekiel 33:11. Verse 17. Besides verse 17, where he says to kill every male. Ezekiel 33:11. God takes no pleasure in the death of the wicked, is what that passage says. Ezekiel 33:11. This is a holy people. The land in which they were going into to conquer, God had given that land and those people time to change. We know that because God is just. We know that because of Jonah when he went to Nineveh. Nineveh was not even a Jewish nation. Had nothing to do with the Israelites. But God gave them a messenger to say, hey, you need to stop what you're doing and change. And just to give us a point of reference, going to Nineveh would be like going to ISIS and saying, hey, would you, repent and stop doing this? As far as the barbarity and the things that they were doing to the tribes of Israel, that's about the equivalent of what Jonah was doing. And so God has always said and told the people before a judgment is passed, he has given them information or time to change. And they did not. And so God, and we'll see later on, that God is using these people, the Israelites, to punish the Canaanites. And he warns them, he says, just as I'm doing to them, I will do to you if you are not obedient. And so we can divine from that that God was trying to get them to change. Yeah, you had a question? It's cattle, donkey, sheep. They were able, I'm not sure if they were able to sacrifice those. I mean, they were clean animals. They weren't taking unclean animals. I'm not sure if they were able to sacrifice those or not. I don't know. All the other stuff that they brought in, they had to this passage talks about they had to clean every article of clothing, of leather, of any tool, any item that they had. They had to wash it in water. They had to stay outside the camp 7 days. Any metal that could pass the fire, is what they say, would have to be smelted down into ingots before it could be brought into camp to purify it. And so there's everything that came into camp had to be purified. And so this is a situation here. And so imagine if you're out in war and every piece of leather of your armor, every piece of everything, all the blood has to come off of it. Everything has to be cleaned. And then you have to go through purification on the seventh day. And then everything, all the people had to be washed, every animal, everything had to be washed to come into the camp. And all the metals had to be burned, processed down to burn off the impurities. And so that's how serious God was about keeping these people holy. And so then that's, God goes through great lengths to keep his people holy. And then in the New Testament, we're commanded to be holy as I am holy. And we need to be kind of maybe more aware of that fact that holiness costs something. It's a process. A very good question. Thank you. At the end of this chapter, in verse 50, the people who went out to plunder said, we have brought an offering to the Lord, what each man found, articles of gold, arm bracelets, and signet rings. And so the plunder that they took off the bodies of the people, they brought that to the Lord and sacrificed that or gave that to the temple. And so again, that was something that we melted down and they took that. All right, moving on to chapter 32. Reuben and Gad settle in Gilead. And Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh are the ones that are going to decide to settle there. So they decide, they're on the west side, east side of the Jordan River. And in that land, it's pretty good land for cattle. And they have lots of cattle. And they decide, hey, we want to just chill here. We want to hang out here. We don't want to go over into the other land. This place is is good enough here. And so Moses says to him, and this is a pretty famous verse 6. He said, Moses said to the sons of Gad and to the sons of Reuben, shall your brothers go to war while yourselves sit here? And he kind of gets on to him, and he says, now, are you going to discourage them and not go in like the other guys that decided they weren't going to go in? Are you going to do that here? And they're like, whoa, we're not going to do that. We will give us time to build cities and fences for our people and for our little ones, and we will go into war with the rest of the tribes. And so they make that promise over and over again that they will go to war, they will go to war, they will go to war. And so they're able to do that. And so Moses, in verse 33, so Moses gave to them the sons of Gad and the sons of Reuben and to the half-tribe of Joseph's son Manasseh, the kingdom of Sidon, the king of the Amorites, the kingdom. And so it talks about what part was divided out for them. Now they're on, as I mentioned before, on the east side. And 2 Kings chapter, you might want to write out here, 2 Kings chapter 15, verse 29. Assyrians came in to conquer the land, they were the first to go because they were out there on that side of the land. So that's 2 Kings 15, 29. Chapter 33, we have the review of the journey from Egypt. We're given a sort of a recap of where they camped. And it would be good at some point maybe to go through with a map and see kind of where these places are. We don't have that kind of time in this class. But I don't know if you've ever, any of you guys read Lord of the Rings at all? Anybody? Nobody? No, just me. Only one geek in hardcore that way. But sometimes if you're reading books and there's a lot of names, you have to flip back and forth between a map to get a perspective of where things are happening. And so in this case, it's very much like that. They were just giving a list of names, where they camped, and some things that happened. And in verse 4, we have an interesting phrase that's mentioned here. While the Egyptians were burying all their firstborn, whom the Lord had struck down among them, the Lord had also executed judgments on their gods. And so it says here they left while everybody was burying their firstborn sons and their firstborn animals and things. They left, walked out in the middle of all that. And it says here, God also executed judgments on their gods. And so the plagues were in reference to specific gods or deities of Egypt. And you can write out there, Exodus 12:12 is a reference there. We're given here, verse 38, the time that Aaron died. He died when he was the age of about 123 years old. Verse 38. And the end of the chapter, verses 50 through 56, we're given this law of possessing the land. And he says, then the Lord spoke to Moses in the plains of Moab by the Jordan, opposite of Jericho, saying, speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when you cross over the Jordan into the land of Canaan, then you shall drive out all the inhabitants of the land and before you, and destroy all their figured stones, and destroy all their molten images, and demolish their high places, and you shall take possession of the land. So here's what they're supposed to do. They're supposed to drive out the inhabitants, destroy all their idols, and take the land from them. And he says, and you will live in it, for I have given the land to you to possess. You shall inherit the land by lot according to your families. The larger ones will give more inheritance, and the smaller ones will give less inheritance. So the land is going to be divided by a lot and according to need. So that's how the system was going to be used. He says, wherever the lot falls to anyone, that shall be his, and you shall inherit according to the tribes of your fathers. But if you do not, here's some foreshadowing. But if you do not drive out the inhabitants of the land from before you, then it shall come about that those whom you let remain of them will become as pricks in your eyes and as thorns in your sides, and they will trouble you in the land which you live. And as I plan to do to them, so will I do to you. And so here is that phrase. If this happens, if you don't drive them out, they're going to be a thorn in your side the whole time. And as I'm doing to you, I will do, or as I'm doing to them, so will I do to you. And so that's a foreshadowing. God knew that they weren't going to necessarily drive out every inhabitant. But they have sort of stopped short of doing just that. Joshua 23, 11 through 13 mentions something to the same effect. Joshua 23, 11 through 13. And again, this passage kind of gives us an idea that God gave the inhabitants of Canaan a chance to turn back, to repent. So he's using Israelites to exact punishment on them. So now we're given the dimensions of the land they're going to be in chapter 34. Verses 1 through 15, we're given the borders, the southern sector, the western, just basically landmarks that were to map out what their land was going to be, verses 1 through 15. And then in verses 16 through 29, we're given those who are supposed to divide out the land to help portion it out to those who are going to receive it in chapter 34. All right, we talked about this earlier. Every tribe was going to get land. Do you remember what the Levites were going to get? What were they going to get? They got up next to the tabernacle. Were they going to get big plots of land, or what were they going to get? They were going to get cities, right? They were going to have cities. The Levites weren't going to have a ton of land to cultivate and that kind of thing. They were going to be given cities. And so chapter 35 talks about that concept of what they were supposed to receive. Cities for the Levites. Verses 1 through 5 talks about those cities. The Lord spoke to Moses in the plains of Moab. In verse 2, it says, command the sons of Israel that they give to the Levites, from the inheritance of their possessions, cities to live in. And so it talks about the cities, and it says that, you know, up to 3,000 feet or 2,000 cubits outside of the city and all the way around it was what was given to them as grazing pasture for their animals that they have. And so that's the extent of the land that they were given. And then it talks about cities of refuge, verses 6 through 34. Cities of refuge. Anybody have an idea what that is, a city of refuge? Yes, sir. Yes. And specifically, if you killed somebody, this was your place to go. Yes. So if you committed a crime, if you killed somebody, you were to go to a city of refuge. And there were six cities of refuge. They were numbered among the 48 cities that the Levites were to receive. So of the 48, six were going to be cities of refuge. And so I'm going to give you some passages to write out if you want to look into more detail about what these cities of refuge are. It gives pretty extensive here. But Joshua 20, 7 through 9 mentions this also. Joshua 20, 7, verses 7 through 9. Deuteronomy 4, 41 through 43. Deuteronomy 4, 41 through 43. And also chapter 19, verses 1 through 13 of Deuteronomy. And it talks about the fact that if somebody struck them with an iron object or a wood object or something like that, then they're murderers, okay? They're murderers. But if they did it by accident, if they accidentally tripped them and they fell on however they died. There's a lot of dumb ways to die. So in this situation, if it was by accident, then they could flee to these cities and plead their case. They would still have to stand trial, but they would have to stay in the city of refuge until the priest, that current priest that was in office, so to speak, at that time, died. And when that current high priest died, then they were able to transfer and able to walk outside of the boundaries of that city. Otherwise, if they walked outside the boundaries of that city, then the one who was the nearest kinsman to that person that died was able to kill him. And so even though they stood trial and it was said it was an accident, they were fine as long as they stayed in that city. So I don't know if they had if those particular cities had roaming bands of people waiting outside the city for people to come out. I don't know if it was kind of one you could do one of these things. I'm in, I'm out, I'm in, I'm out. Yes, sir. They had no refuge. No, the ones that was obvious that they killed somebody, you know, it was an accident that I buried my axe into a skull. No, that was pretty on purpose. But it was that was on purpose. So those guys, no, there was no refuge for them. But those who did it by accident, there was refuge, as long as they stayed inside the confines of that particular city that they fled to, and then it would be annulled as soon as the priest that was a current high priest of that time died, if they lived long enough to see that. And in verse 34 is an interesting concept. You shall not defile the land in which you live, in the midst of which I dwell. For I, the Lord, am dwelling in the midst of the sons of Israel. And it says, it talks about that the person can only be put to death at the voice of two witnesses in verse 30. And also that you must kill the person who was a murderer. A murderer must die. If it's found that they are a murderer, they are defiling the land if they stay in the land and they are not killed. And so that's what this passage is reference to. They are defiling the land if they are not killed also. And chapter 36, we have an inheritance by marriage. We are presented with a problem in the first few verses, first four verses. And the heads of the father's house of the family of Gilead, and the sons of Machir, and the sons of Manasseh, the families of the sons of Joseph, came near and spoke to Moses before the leaders. And it says, the Lord commanded my Lord to give the land by lot to the sons of Israel as an inheritance, and my Lord was commanded by the Lord to give inheritance to Zelophehad, our brother, and to his daughters. But if they marry one of the sons of other tribes, the sons of Israel, their inheritance will be withdrawn from the inheritance of our fathers. And so what they're saying is, these girls received, the ones we talked about earlier, they received inheritance. And as I mentioned earlier, this passage tells us that they could only marry inside their family, or not immediate family, because that would be weird, but inside the tribe of their tribe, so that the land would not pass to another tribe. And so what they're saying is the inheritance from a tribe cannot pass to another tribe. Land that is given to that tribe stays inside that land. And so we're given basically that judgment that they can marry, they can have that inheritance, but they must marry inside that tribe. So the land stays to that tribe. And then verse 13, we have the closing of this book. These are the commandments and the ordinances which the Lord commanded the sons of Israel through Moses in the plains of Moab, by the Jordan, opposite of Jericho. So we've come a long ways in this book. We've come a long ways. Where were we when we started this book? Mount Sinai, right? We stayed there for a few chapters, and then we left. And we were all over the place. A lot of people died. People did things they shouldn't have and died. And then they kind of learned their lesson and started turning around. A next generation rose up. And now we're poised to start Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy, as we'll get to it, is three sermons, basically a bunch of sermons preparing the people to go into the land. And so we'll start that next time. Any questions or anything before we close? All right, thank you.